The most trusted and longest running sports talk show in Tennessee. From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting, this is Sports Talk with John Wilkerson and Jimmy Hines on Sports Radio WNML.
I'm Jimmy Hines, along with Ben Farrar. Rob Lewis, who typically joins us on Monday at this time, has a conflict that just arose, so we look forward to trying to reschedule him. Before we get to our callers, I do want to mention that Trey Smith spoke with ESPN. Tennessee's offensive lineman had a number of interesting things to say. He said it would be borderline ignorant to say that it's not concerning to play football with the COVID-19 out there. He continues his quote, "We definitely talked about it as a family, prayed about it, and asked God to protect me. The doctors at Tennessee and Coach Pruitt have been great at keeping us informed on everything. But at the end of the day, we as players have to take the proper precautions. So, yes, it's something you weigh. Is it worth it? Is it not worth it? Ultimately, to get to my dream goals and aspirations, it's worth the risk for me." Interesting comments from Trey Smith. He also said that it would tick me off to my core if we're snubbed and that opportunity gets taken away from me to go out there and prove myself. I'm not knocking any president or chancellor who absolutely do fabulous jobs, but it would be awesome as players if we could be informed and heard from and quit finding out things about the season possibly being canceled on Twitter and in the media. Close quote. So interesting from Trey Smith. We've wondered for a while, would he play, would he not? He says it's worth the risk for me, Vince.
Well, and I think you have to take them by that, because it's speculation to say that, you know, just how to gauge just how much more at risk he is with COVID-19. There you would think he would be, but we don't know to what degree and all that with his condition. So it's hard to make that medical claim if you're not in his position or his doctor. So obviously it's something that he's got to consider and has, but it also sounds like, you know, clearly it's worth the risk for him. And I thought it's very interesting. He's not the first player to express the frustration that they find out about things on Twitter. Hey, join the club. I mean, a lot of us, unfortunately, are seeing that, and just everything you see on there isn't always correct and accurate. That's another thing we have to consider before everyone runs to retweet and say, hey, look, like my tweet, because I have the scoop. So that part of it is very frustrating. You wish there was more communication. That might have been prior to Chancellor Plowman talking to the team today. I don't know, but that's a pretty good step. I don't know how much of a Q&A maybe happened there. I would love to be there and hear, all right, is she taking questions and taking tough questions from the players to say, what is this all about? What are you really considering? You're talking about our health, but is this about amateurism? Is this about litigation? Give it to me straight. What is this about? And I would love to see that kind of exchange between presidents and chancellors and the student athletes, that they get to be there to hear them speak. But, he is the key person in terms of his health condition to kind of gauge where he's at. And I do think that the players are doing the right thing by voicing their opinion on where they stand and wanting a greater line of communication. And I don't think that's failed with Jeremy Pruitt. I just think it comes from above and then from the top, and then you see the reports rather than giving them the heads up of what the next step and what their considerations are.
So he's Trey Smith. I want to play. I want to prove myself. He also indicated that he feels safe at Tennessee and on their campus, and that it's safer than going out and in public, because it's transmitted more outside the facility. But here's the thing about that, and I get what he's saying, and I get what Nick Saban is saying about the safety and the limited number of positive tests. But it's a whole nother ball game when you get out there and you start playing football against an opponent. Yes, you probably are safer in the football facility in a controlled environment, but all bets are off when you start knocking heads with somebody on the football field. So I really don't buy the argument that you're safer right now. Let me rephrase that. You may be safer right now where you are, but that doesn't mean you're going to be safer when you take to the football field and knock heads with somebody for 75 plays in a ball game. So that to me is where the risk comes in. It's not so much you staying in a semi-bubble at your school. It's when you start playing the actual games.
But Jimmy, in theory, because of the frequent testing, you would hope that those players that are coming in frequent contact with each other are negative for COVID-19. So is that going to be absolute? Probably not. But
no.
That's what they're – yes, but they're – in terms of minimizing the impact of it, if 99% of the people you're around, football field or not, are negative for it, I mean, you could very well, whether it's in a college classroom, grocery store, wherever you might happen to go, might be greater percentages there outside of where you go and what you do than if you know most people around, if you there, maybe not know, but if the reality of it is there are a lot of people that are negative that you're interacting with, then yeah, that I'm not assuming just because you're knocking heads with somebody and throwing sweat around that you're going to get COVID-19, because if they don't have it, then it doesn't matter. Then it's just normal the way it's been. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I'm just saying that I wouldn't think just because of the close contact that you can get COVID-19, because they're hoping to be able to alleviate that with testing throughout the week. Is the testing enough? Well, that's a different story. You know, in professional ranks, they're testing constantly, so there's less of that. And the issues when guys are getting it in Major League Baseball seems to be when they're going and doing something outside of their protocols and then coming back. Yes, that could happen with college as well, but inside just football itself, I don't know that that adds to the risk than everyday life, especially if they're going back home where they're not going to have structure, and college football players and athletes rely on that structure so much. When guys get into trouble, much less not take precautions for COVID, it's when they're away from their normal structure, when they go back home over a break or whatever. So I do think that they are safer there, and I wouldn't assume because they're exchanging sweat, especially if they have face masks on top of that. I'm not assuming that, well, they're going to get it then, because you hope that most of those players are negative.
I am assuming they're going to get it. Vince, there's no way around it. There's no way around it. I don't care. And one of the things, first off, they better make sure they get the testing back. If you get the test on Wednesday, you need to make sure you get that test back in an appropriate time. But
right.
You could test on Wednesday and get it on Thursday or Friday and not know it. Now, I know they talked about trying to test again on the morning of a game or the day of a game, but I think it's highly unreasonable to say that you're going to play football games and people are not going to have positive tests coming out of them.
Go ahead.
There is no way that's going to happen. So now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not sure if you were changing the argument or expanding on it. I'm not saying that right now in the football facility it's not a whole lot better than going back to their home. But what I am saying is when you start playing football games, there's going to be an outbreak. I'm telling you, there will be an outbreak. And I think that you can argue against it, and that's fine. I don't believe it. I'm telling you, there will be an outbreak that will occur. Now, I'm not saying that's worse than going back home and living somewhere where people aren't abiding by the rules. I'm just saying we're going to have some positive tests coming out of this when you start playing football games. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that there wouldn't be, but I think in comparison to not being there, I don't know that it's a greater percentage because you're playing football and you're in close contact with one another. And then of course, if there is an outbreak, is that because a kid made the wrong decision, or is it because of just football itself? I think that's where there's the assumption is where it's football, of course you're going to get it. Well, is it, are you getting it because someone didn't make the right decision, or it because of just the nature of football? I don't think just the nature of football gets it. I think it would be if someone makes a bad decision, brings it onto the field, and then you do it. In the end, it may not matter, but I don't think just football itself is more dangerous or less safe than them going back or being a part of society.
We can't get Major League Baseball players to abide by the rules, or NBA players to abide by the rules, or NFL players. So why would you think college football players are going to be saints about this? They're not. They're going to do some things they're not supposed to. They're going to sneak out. They're going to cross that line and order food from Uber. It's going to happen. I get my point is this, and I don't know whether with that far off base, but here's my point. To say that right now in your facility we've got less than 2% that are testing positive, therefore let's go play games, and you expect the same 2% to occur, I'm not buying that. That's not happening. There are going to be some positive tests that crop up, and there are going to be some outbreaks. That's what I'm saying. It could be that somebody was tested and it didn't show, and they got it after the Wednesday test. It could be that they violated protocol and went out, went to a party. Whatever it is, it's unreasonable to think you're not going to have an outbreak if you play football. That's my opinion.
Well, and I don't think we're that far off, Jimmy, on how we envision this going. Maybe it's semantics and what we're going back and forth on. I think travel is another aspect of it that's a little bit of an unknown.
Yeah.
You know, that adds to the element. I'm not pie in the sky and think that this is going to go flawless. It's just a matter of the risk and how many of the kids take it seriously. The NBA, they had a couple of cases because when guys left the bubble, but I don't think in the bubble they've really had any issues. And I know the NHL hasn't had any whatsoever.
They've
so,
been amazing.
Yes, Major League. Yeah, absolutely. Over 18,000 tests in a three-week period without a single positive test. And that doesn't surprise me. That's hockey players. That's their mindset, that they're going to take it seriously and they're going to watch out for their family around them. But, yes, with college students, absolutely. You mentioned Zach Plesac, how he had to leave. He said afterwards, he's like, in a statement, well, you know, now I realize that I put my team in danger and, you know, I got to take all the precautions. How did you not realize that beforehand?
That's right.
You know, why does it take that? So, yes, that kind of stuff is going to happen. Can you minimize it to where you don't bring it back in and it automatically spreads? Is this something that happens on say a Saturday night where someone breaks protocol, and then if they get tested before coming back into the facility on Monday, then they're able to keep that keep the player
spreading.
From bringing that in their facility and spreading. Yeah. So right. How they handle it is a part of what kind of outbreak you have as well.
Let's go to Tom. Tom's been waiting patiently. Hello, Tom.
Hey, guys. Let me take a speaker. Okay, so I was looking at all the scenarios that I thought was interesting about how they kind of picked the SEC, you know, all SEC games. And I kept thinking, are they testing a possible realignment? And one thing I was like, when they announced it, I was like, I guess we're going to be playing Auburn, because it just felt like that was going to happen no matter what, and I was right. And I was like, they're going to have Missouri play somebody in the more West teams. And I keep thinking that even if we don't have a season, they're already considering realignment. And another possibility, maybe add some teams, because I could see some teams, maybe teams out of like maybe Louisville or Oklahoma State, all thinking maybe it's time to go to the SEC. So I was wondering, is realignment possible in the near future now more than ever, or picking up some new schools?
Tom, I'll touch on the SEC realignment. So what you're talking about is teams switching divisions within the league. I don't think so. This was kind of a funny story. But I want to say it was a little over a year ago at the SEC spring meetings, Greg Sankey was asked about the realignment, and he said the only people that bring that up are you guys in the media. Well, that afternoon, the athletic director at Auburn brought it up and said that he would like to move into the East. And so it's like, well, no, wait a minute. We're not the only ones. The AD at Auburn, now he's not the AD at Auburn anymore. I don't think that had anything to do with it. I don't think they are seriously considering it. I don't think it's been an agenda item. I don't think it's getting discussed a lot. And I don't think this is a test for realignment. I don't. So as far as adding teams, Vince, do you think that what's going on right now could lend itself to the SEC or other conferences adding teams?
Maybe on a one-off, you know, just a one-year type of thing, sort of like the ACC bringing in Notre Dame, if they were to get, you know, some kind of waiver from their current conference to play if they wanted to pursue it. I could see the SEC doing it, especially if it's a Ohio State. If they, you know, if it's Ohio State in Michigan or Ohio State in Nebraska, a 1 year, you think the SEC won't put a giant Sharpie X over their schedule and start over to redo that? Of course they would. And ESPN and networks would jump on that as well. So I don't think permanently they would do something like that. But if you could make it work for 1 year, I think they would. And in terms of positioning for a realignment within the conference, there are plenty of schools like Arkansas getting two Southeast schools in Georgia and Florida, Vanderbilt getting LSU and Mississippi State. There are plenty of other examples of Texas A&M getting Tennessee and Florida. There are a few that maybe would fit geographically with what they were added, but there are plenty that wouldn't. I don't know. I mean, who knows once this year happens or however it happens, anything could be possible. But I don't think they put out the schedule with that in mind, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't either. That's Vince Ferrar. I'm Jimmy Himes. When we come back, we'll have more. If you want to join us, 656-9900, 1-866-656-9900. This is Sports Talk 99.1, the Sports Animal.
From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting.
Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately.
I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
This is Sports Radio WNML.
Welcome back to Sports Talk. I'm Jimmy Himes with Vince Ferrar. Let's go to the phones where Fred is our next caller. Hello, Fred.
Jimmy, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. I have not been able to hear much of your program because I've been working in the last week and so forth. But if I'm going to ask you something that's totally different from the last topic we've been talking about football players and playing and so forth. So if you all have discussed this, I'll apologize in front, but I see a real conflict of interest in having a trustee that is the head basketball coach for the female team at Duke. And I wondered, number one, do you see a conflict of interest in that? And do you have any idea whether or not the chairman of the trustees discussed, from the article in the paper the other day, it sounded like that she was really maybe going to ask to be get off the trustees, but he talked her into staying. Do you know whether he discussed this with Fulmer or the president of the university or the chancellor or especially Kelly Harper?
I do not know where the discussions were, Fred. I don't know. I don't know if there were discussions about that. I don't think the head coach at Duke in women's basketball or any other sport should be on the board of trustees at the University of Tennessee. I think there's a potential for an inherent conflict of interest. The potential's there. And so yeah. I don't think you should have that.
I assume that the chairman of the trustees knows that we have a women's basketball team over there, and now he has a trustee of the University of Tennessee that's going to be in direct competition with her on occasion, possibly.
It's not that I think Carol Lawson would do something that would be a vote in favor of Duke to hurt Tennessee, whatever that might be. I just think it's a bad look. I wouldn't do it. I think it's conflict of interest.
Well, I can let's just assume that you've got this great five-star 6.66 center who's the best thing since night baseball, and she's lowered her choices to Tennessee and Duke. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that the trustee of the University of Tennessee is going to be really all for Tennessee, or do you think she's going to try to get her to come to her team? It's obvious she's going to work against Tennessee, in my opinion, and work for Duke. And I think it is absolutely ridiculous for her to continue to be a trustee.
No argument for me.
Yeah. So you don't know whether he discussed it with anybody in the administration or in the sports agenda or anything of that nature then?
No, but I'm going to snoop around and see if I can find out.
I wish you would, because I think it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I appreciate you talking to me, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Fred. Let's go to Bill. Bill, you're on Sports Talk.
Hey Jimmy, I had a question on this, whether the Pac-12 or Pac-10 and the Big Ten, whatever, are they cutting or eliminating any type of school classes on campus, and everything is being done online?
Bill, I don't know if they're all being done online. I know that there was talk of that. Vince, do you know if they're doing it all online? Do you know that?
No, it's not across the board. I think each university is a little bit different. Their percentages for some. It varies school to school. So there's not all the schools in our conference are doing it one way versus the other. No.
Yeah, I don't know why the presidents of these schools, man. I don't know how football gets singled out, I guess, is my concern. I can guarantee you one thing. I know you talked about these athletes, no matter what, there's going to be COVID. You let students on campus, especially if students live on campus, live in apartments or whatever, I'll bet you there's much more COVID with those students than athletes.
I bet
you're
right.
I think there's any question. You know, so I don't. If you're going to shut down football, to me, the only reason to do that is because you're shutting down. Nobody's going to be on campus. And it just doesn't. I don't know why football is being singled out as something that is, it's wrong for these people to play football, versus why is it right for the kids to go to school on campus when they can do it online, not be on campus, not be in apartments, and have much less of a chance of having COVID-19. So it seems like there's a conflict. I just wanted your opinions on that.
I can tell you that a professor at the University of Tennessee told me that the majority of his classes would be online, but he would have some classes that were very, very small where they would do it on campus. Now, is that to justify, okay, this says that we've got in-class courses, therefore we can have football? I don't know. I'm not sure all the reasoning behind it, but that's what somebody told me at the University of Tennessee.
Hmm. Are they going to allow the kids to stay in dorms that were in apartments?
I don't know the answer to that.
What I've seen is if they don't play, they're not going to force them to go back home. Was what some of the reports that I've seen is that, yeah, they would still, even if they don't play, they would be allowed to still, you know, come in and work out and do the things they would normally do, go to classes, be in their housing, but they're not going to play football. So they wouldn't at least be forced to go home. So that's where a little bit of the argument of football versus home, what's safer? If they don't force them to, then that takes care of that a little bit. But then you're to your point, then you're kind of singling out football because that's the only difference in that scenario.
Yeah, that would be. I mean, most colleges, I'm sure, and it sounds like most players would sign a waiver if they had to, if they weren't worried so much about litigation. You know, I just find that odd that football is getting singled out so much, especially if the campuses are going to be open for students, or if you're going to keep the football players and other athletes there, and they're going to train and do all these things and go to school. Now, if you're talking play football and also have 35,000 fans in the stands, different conversation. I mean, that changes the scope of it. But I think from the sweat and all the work and everything, I mean, the NBA has pretty much proven you can have contact sports, maybe not to the degree of football, but those guys certainly are pounding on each other and everything, and they seem to be managing that fairly well. But you're right, there's going to be some exceptions. So I appreciate your answers. I was just trying to get a feel for it. I feel for that because I just haven't seen much said about that.
Okay. Hey, Bill, we appreciate it. Thanks for the call. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Chip Towers of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He covers the Georgia Bulldogs. With Vince Ferrara, I'm Jimmy Himes, Sports Talk 99.1, the sports animal.
I'm VFL Charles Davis, and it's
47 days until
it's football time in Tennessee.
This Sports Radio WNML countdown to kickoff is brought to you by Knoxville TVA Employees Credit Union. Find out more at tvacreditunion.com.
Go on!
We are pleased now to be joined by longtime friend Chip Towers with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Chip covers the Georgia Bulldogs. Chip, how are you?
Well, I'm fantastic. I'm a little dizzy from following the events of, college football over the last 72 hours, but I think I got my bearings back and time to talk to you guys.
Does it strike you as being pretty odd that the SEC comes out with a schedule, the two opponents on a Friday night? The Big Ten right before that came out with their schedule. Now the Big Ten's talking about shutting it down. If you're talking about shutting it down, what was the purpose of coming out with your schedule at that point? Any thoughts on that?
Well, all of it's kind of weird. Look, I guess at the end of it all, we should be empathetic maybe of the leaders in college football and in college athletics, because the alternative to that is being impatient and annoyed with them. And it really is a very, very difficult thing they're trying to figure out. But, as I'm, really writing as we speak right now and about the post on the AJC, that the morning – began with a really rainy day, gloomy forecast, and it ended with I think rainbows and sunshine. At the end of the day, you see the UT chancellor and the Ole Miss AD and Greg Sankey coming out with very positive statements on their social media channels. So this is not a day, even a day-to-day endeavor. It's an hour by hour, and at this hour, it looks pretty favorable, I would say, for the SEC staying on course to play.
I wanted to ask you about the schedule that was released, and a number of people have this opinion, I'm one of them, that it looked like the SEC was trying to sort of protect the upper echelon of the league and not inflict another possible loss on them, the way they scheduled Alabama and Georgia and who's the other one I saw there?
Florida and LSU.
Florida. LSU was one of them. LSU got Vanderbilt and Missouri. Georgia gets Arkansas, Mississippi State. Alabama gets Missouri, Kentucky. At least Florida has to play one of the top 15 teams in A&M. Did it look to you like the SEC was trying to take care of the upper echelon?
It did. In fact, it's kind of counterintuitive for me. I'm used to covering a Georgia team that its fan base is convinced that the SEC office is trying to screw them. And, adding Arkansas and Mississippi State, they obviously came out pretty good. And look, the one thing you're never going to get, Mark Womack or Greg Sankey or anybody in the SEC to get in great detail is about exactly how did you come up with that schedule? Was it mathematical or what? And I think, if we cut through all the bulls, Jimmy, that at the end of the day, everything that's taking place in college football and in the SEC is to preserve television inventory. I mean, that's what I think is happening here. And, you, you know, you, you, for that, you need good guys and bad guys for good TV. And, you know, maybe they use some sort of power rankings based on expectations for the season, or maybe it was anecdotal, or maybe it just sort of turned out that way. But, you know, if you're Arkansas or Missouri, I'm sure you're coming away going, are you kidding me? Seriously? I mean, we already had the toughest, as the Arkansas said, we already had the toughest schedule in all of football, and now we have the toughest schedule in the history of college football. And, yeah, it's hard to argue with that when you see how it all turned out.
Well, Chip, the only argument I would have is the most difficult schedule in college football was when they had a 12-game schedule with non-conference games. Well, that went away a while ago, so you no longer have that title. You're right. They already had a tough schedule, and they got really laid it to them. I'm wondering, the storyline, as you know, Chip, between Georgia and Florida was that Florida had a little bit of a scheduling advantage going in. So I think some people that thought the two teams were close gave Florida maybe the edge in the East. Now that we've seen those two games added and the strength of schedule is very similar between those two teams, how do you think that's been canceled out now in the end between Florida and Georgia, to where it'll be more on the field versus any schedule playing a factor?
Well, I don't think it's been completely evened out. I mean, I do think it was mitigated to some extent. A road trip to Texas A&M is no small task in any season. So I there's no question that added a difficulty factor to Florida's schedule that wasn't there before. And then, you know, home against Arkansas, who knows? Felipe Franks returns to Gainesville. If you look at the two, Georgia and Florida, I'd say Georgia made out better getting Mississippi State and Arkansas. But at Arkansas is nothing to sneeze at either. I mean, you know, it's the SEC, and all those places are tough to play at. But then there's the added factor of the crowds, right? If I had to guess sitting here today, and my goodness, who wants to guess in this day and age? But I would say you're looking at probably a 20% mandate by the SEC. I mean, whatever's going to happen on crowds, which hasn't been announced yet, on spectators, what I'm hearing is generally a, CDC guidelines, social distancing, adhering setup, which in, by all indications is what you're doing in the NFL, is about 20%. So at Texas A&M in a season of COVID, it's not as difficult as at Texas A&M would be in a regular season, right? So, at the end of the day, you still got to play them and you still got to win them. And right now, we're just trying to get to a point where we're sure they're going to play them.
Chip, has there been any discussion that you've heard to play the Georgia-Florida game on campus versus in Jacksonville?
Well, that's something that certainly Georgia and athletic director Greg McGarity and Scott Strickland, for that matter, the Florida AD, are adamant about keeping it in Jacksonville. And, the pandemic being considered, they are contractually bound to play that game in Jacksonville if a game is played. Now, certainly the SEC could override that and they could play on camp, but, Greg McGarity was pretty outspoken, and he's not very outspoken on a whole lot of things, but he was pretty outspoken about saying, we don't want, because this year Georgia has the home game, so, Florida comes to Georgia and plays in front of 20,000 fans or 19,000, and then Georgia would return the game to Gainesville next year and play before 90,000. That wouldn't be fair to anybody involved, so I think if this gets played, it's going to go ahead and be played in Jacksonville, which in that stadium, they're adhering to NFL rules anyway with the Jaguars, which right now the plan is for a 20% crowd. So, again, you're talking about a significantly reduced spectator base for that game, whether it's played in Jacksonville, Gainesville, or Athens.
I guess Chip Towers with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Chip, we had Philip Fulmer on, Tennessee's athletic director, recently, he said that he's looking for like 20 to 50% at capacity at Neyland Stadium, 50% being on the high end of it, but more likely it'll be 20 to 25%, maybe 33%. What's Georgia looking at? What have you heard they're trying to accomplish or what their goal would be?
Well, what I'm hearing is that you're not going to have it done piecemeal like that, where Tennessee has 50%, Georgia has 20%, and so on. This is going to be like everything else. That's what's taken everything so long to get decided, is the SEC is going to mandate all of this stuff, and so that it's, so that there's not any any kind of advantages that can be even perceived on the far end of it. And all indications are 20% is the model that's going to end up getting utilized.
And I'm going to assume that they're not going to be providing tickets for visiting teams, right?
Yeah, that's where we haven't gotten down in the weeds yet, and I'm so fascinated to find out, right? Because I mean, if you're talking about 20% of Sanford Stadium, this is the only one that I've looked in to, you know, in great detail. You're talking about, you know, a little bit over 19,000. It holds about 93,000. So you're looking about at a little bit over 19,000. Well, you know, the regular allotment for students is 17,000, maybe 17,000 plus. So those students are coming back on campus. Georgia students are returning on August 20th. I had a conversation today with a UGA official who told me in no uncertain terms that's going to happen. I mean, regardless of what the pandemic does, these students are coming back, and all these protocols are being put in place. But now, how do you break it down? So if you just let all your students that want to go, I mean, technically you could have as many as 17,000. Well, that doesn't leave a whole lot left over. You know, for I think the next accommodation you got to make is player families, and once you know they're promised on the regular 4 tickets a person. So you know, you get to 19,000 pretty doggone fast without, you know, carrying one iota of your fat cat donors, right? And there's a lot of those people out there. So I'm not sure how that's going to look. And again, I think it'll probably be fairly dictated by the conference. But I do think that the students and parents need to come first in this equation. I know all these donors give a lot of money to these programs and deserve. I mean, that, you know, you can say whatever you want about that philosophically, but the fact of the matter is they've laid down their money for the right to be there. But at the end of the day, I think player families and students need to be catered to first. That's just my opinion. You know, we'll have to see how they decide to go with it.
God, that's going to be interesting to see how that breaks out. That 17,000 for Georgia is a whole lot more than what Tennessee allots its students. So
is that right? Numbers. Yeah, it's actually recently been expanded because they had so many. But of course, you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, trends along cyclical lines of how the programs are going. You know, and Georgia's rolling right now, and all the students want in. But that was always the case, and certainly Tennessee has a huge season ticket fan base, and you know, you got to cater to those people too. So it's always a tough equation for ticket managers to figure out.
Yep, it's going to be interesting. Hey, Chip, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us.
All right, thanks, see you on the other side.
Yes, sir. That is Chip Towers with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We appreciate him visiting with us, and he joins us on the Stanley Fenson Gates hotline. When we come back, we'll have more with Vince Ferrar. I'm Jimmy Himes, Sports Talk 99.1, the Sports Animal.
Turn us up and embarrass the Alabama fan that sits in the next cubicle. This is 99.1, the Sports Animal.
Welcome back to Sports Talk. Let's go to the phones real quick with Jim. Jim, you're on ahead of a break. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, guys. I just wanted to reinforce everything that's been said on this program this afternoon, including your last two guests. I did a little preseason power poll ranking system in which I took the preseason coaches' polls and ranked the teams, and I assigned points. Alabama has 14, Georgia 13, LSU 12, and on down the line. Florida, Auburn, Texas A&M, followed by Tennessee, Kentucky, Mississippi State, Ole Miss, South Carolina, Missouri. By doing that, if you go and assign the points, and then you take the two teams that were added, it reinforces everything that has been said on this program this afternoon. LSU picked up 4 points. Georgia picked up 8. Alabama picked up 10. And Florida picked up 12. Those are the teams that are in the hunt for the playoffs, I think everybody would agree on. By contrast, Arkansas picked up 25 points. A&M did pick up 20. They evened out A&M's schedule by adding Florida and Tennessee. So when all is said and done, at the end of the day, you take those points and combine it with their full schedule, and according to my calculations using this formula, Auburn and Arkansas have the toughest schedules in the SEC with 80 points. The easiest schedule in the SEC is Florida, LSU, and Georgia. Alabama fits into the middle of the equation with 75 points. Tennessee has 74. So by applying this mathematical equation, it reinforces everything that is being said. And at the end of the day, of the big five that have a chance for the SEC championship, you have Alabama with 75, Georgia with 66, LSU with 65, and Florida with 64. Auburn with 80, and Texas A&M with 73. At the other end of the equation, South Carolina has 79, Missouri has 78, Vandy has 78, Arkansas has 80. So it's reinforcing mathematically with this simple equation exactly what everybody has been saying. And they have, for whatever reason, made it to where the teams that are going to challenge for the SEC championship have the easiest overall schedules.
Yep.
Having said that, and back to this, should we have fans or not? If I were the president of the universities, why would I, if I were going to allow 10,000 season ticket holders into my stadium, and I had 60,000 season ticket holders, why would I want to make 50,000 season ticket holders upset? If I were the SEC, I would do exactly what baseball has done. We will play. We will have all these protocols in place. We will protect our players as best we can, and we will have no fans. As a result, then you won't have a lot of upset fans. And in addition, if there were going to be anybody in the stadium at all, I agree with your previous guest. They should be students and parents of the players.
Okay. Hey, Jim, we got to run. We're up against it, but thanks for your phone call, okay? And when we come back, we are going to have the Sports Fix at 6, but we also have a very special guest in the 6 o'clock hour, Tom Luganville with ESPN. This is Sports Talk 99.1, the Sports Animal.